From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. How much do you sleep at night? Count it out. Average night. If you're like most Americans, you're lucky to get 7 hours, but most don't get quite that. In fact, 30% of American adults get less than six. Up until the 1800s, people around the world were sleeping 10 hours a night on average. Imagine it. But then came the gas lamp and the light bulb, and you know what happened after that. There's work and the daily demands on our time, and sleep is one of those things we figure we can kind of borrow from, but you can't, or you shouldn't anyway. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on fitness by talking about the importance of sleep. We'll talk about what sleep does for our bodies, what happens when we don't get enough. We'll also talk about naps and caffeine and snoring and what sleep is really supposed to look like after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We have a complicated relationship with sleep, most of us. We've all heard the stories of people who have better things to do with their time than just lie there. Marissa Mayer, head of Yahoo, says she only needs about 4 hours a night. Same with Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter. The fashion mogul Tom Ford says he gets about three, just like Martha Stewart. And just look how successful they are. Maybe the problem is this impression that we're not really getting anything done when we sleep. The fact is, your body is doing all kinds of things when you're zonked out. It's repairing cells and stripping out toxins. It's resetting your rhythm. It's transferring the stuff from our short-term memories into the long-term parts. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on fitness by talking about sleep. Our guest, Dr. Michael Bruce, writes a lot about the connection between fitness and sleep, how a lack of sleep can lead to hypertension and diabetes and heart disease, and he says it can make you fat. We invite you to join the conversation today. Comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Just how much sleep do you get a night? Do you take a nap? Do you notice a difference in your health or general fitness when you do get enough sleep or when you don't get enough? What's keeping you from getting enough sleep? And what do you want to know about how sleep affects your body? Again, 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Dr. Michael Bruce is a clinical psychologist and a certified sleep specialist. He's both a diplomat of the American Board of Sleep Medicine and a fellow of the American Academy of Sleep, author of the book, The Sleep Doctor's Diet Plan, Lose Weight Through Better Sleep. We had a bit of a mix-up this morning, and so we're talking to Dr. Bruce via a cell phone. He's been good enough to sort of indulge us, and so we're going to have to sort of bear with this, I think, for the time being. Dr. Bruce, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I want to ask you first, will you explain your interest? What got you interested in this idea, this subject in the first place?
Well, you know, it was kind of fascinating. When I was in graduate school getting my PhD in clinical psychology, one of the things that I felt like made sense was to try to learn more about just people in general. And I'd always been kind of fascinated by sleep, and so I took a rotation in, as a matter of fact, sleep disorders. And by the third day, I had absolutely, positively fallen in love with clinical sleep medicine because I can help people literally in 24 hours. It's pretty amazing. The treatment gains that we see happen are pretty spectacular in the wide, wonderful world of sleep. And it's because there's so many people out there who really don't have enough information about it. You know, I always like to tell people that nobody's sleeper is broken. Everybody has the ability to fall asleep. It's a natural process. It's something that's definitely going to occur. And what we have to do is we have to remind people how to do that or make sure that they're not doing something else that could be preventing it.
Over time, human beings have we seems like we're sleeping less. I mean, you write in your book in the 19th century, no, up until the 19th century, it was pretty normal for men and women to sleep as much as 10 hours a night.
Yep. Pretty amazing. But, you know, what happened was with the advent of the light bulb, which is a little bit earlier than what you're talking about, It changed everything. It changed everybody's sleep patterns pretty dramatically. I'm pretty convinced that with the advent of overtime, I think that really changed everybody's habits even more dramatically. With the light bulb, you know, we got into the Industrial Revolution and people were no longer, we weren't as agricultural-based society as we are now as we used to be. And so before, everything was based on sun up, sun down, or while the sun is up, you're working. And so people would sleep when it was dark. With the advent of the light bulb, it allowed for people to work basically 24/7. With the advent of double time or, you know, extra time at work, what we, you know, overtime, we now know that people will spend that time to earn more money and they're not going to spend less time with their families, and usually they kind of squelch out sleep.
Yeah. One thing you point out, and we'll get to the particulars of this that go into this question, but you say the feeling of not being tired. Everyone says that. You say that feeling is not normal.
That's correct. That is correct. So the feeling of not – well, wait. Now, what did you say? The feeling of not being tired?
This feeling of being tired. That's what I meant to say.
Yes.
The feeling of being tired.
The feeling
that's
of
not
being
normal.
Tired is absolutely not a normal feeling. There's a big difference between being tired and being fatigued. And people have to be able to, you know, parse those out. But at the end of the day, you shouldn't be tired. You absolutely should be relaxed. You should be able to have energy. You should be able to do function and do all the things you need to do throughout the day without your eyelids dropping, without any of those exterior problems.
So let's start with some of the most basic questions. Explain, Dr. Bruce, what exactly is happening when we sleep? What is our body doing in particular? What's going on when we're sleeping?
Oh, that's a great question. First of all, it's kind of interesting. We don't actually know why we sleep.
Hmm.
It's kind of amazing, but true. Science really hasn't had the opportunity yet to figure it out exactly as to why we sleep. But we do know a couple of different things that happen to occur while we sleep. First of all, as your eyes close, your heart rate begins to slow down. As your heart rate begins to slow down, so does your breathing, and a lot of the different biological functions kind of go into what I would call healing mode. And so what do I mean by that? Is sleep is healing, bottom line. That's how it works. And we have different stages of sleep, and there's different types of healing that go on during the different stages. So as an example, one of the things that we know is that when you go into stage one and stage two sleep, that's really kind of a light buffer type of sleep. That's not really a sleep that has a whole lot of meaning other than we need to have it in order to get to stages three, four, and REM. Stages three and four is really the deep wake up and feel great sleep. That's the sleep that does all the physical restoration. That's where we have the largest emittance of growth hormone. That's where we have people who are really starting to get a lot more from their sleep from a true physical healing perspective. But when you look at sleep from a REM sleep perspective, what we see is that's where the mentally restorative sleep comes in. And so that's where you move information from your short-term memory to your long-term memory. That's where you organize your thoughts and put your thoughts into different places that will allow for easier retrieval, that will allow you to remember things like where did you put your car keys and going to the grocery store, trying to remember that list, things of that nature. But sleep overall as a final purpose, we unfortunately have no idea.
It's interesting. I wonder how much – so obviously in this we'll get into some sort of deeper details about this, but the idea of how much it is we need. I mean, I mentioned, you know, you hear about, you know, Martha Stewart only needs 3 hours of sleep or Tom Ford only needs – what is going on with those guys? Are they you know, genetic mutants in some kind of way, or are there people who do in fact need less, or is it just, are you a little worried for Martha Stewart's sleep patterns?
Well, here's what we know. There are such things as people who are what we call short sleepers.
Yeah.
So these are people who really only require 4.5 to 5 hours of sleep. But I'll tell you, these people are very few and far between. Interestingly, though, these people do have a great tendency to be highly successful because they got so much time on their hands.
Yeah.
And they've got the ability to be involved in so many different things. So, I mean, from that standpoint, I would tell you, hey, There are some people out there that are like that. But are they mutants? Yeah, they're pretty much mutants. I mean, I think that's a pretty safe bet to say, hey, you know what? These people are definitely genetic anomalies. It's not something to shoot for, and it's not something that you can create within yourself. You either got it or you don't.
Well, that must worry you, the emulating that dynamic of certain successful people. Oh, they don't sleep. So presuming that anyone can, it's important to say, no, it's, again, as you said, it's an anomaly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wish I could dunk a basketball, but I'm 5'9".
Yeah.
And it's just not going to happen unless I use a trampoline. That's just not one of the gifts that God seems to have given me. So that being said, everybody gets their gifts. And, you know, if you're gifted as a short sleeper, I will tell you that while a lot of those people are highly successful, a lot of those people suffer from depression, primarily because they're up when nobody else is. And so it gets pretty lonely out there.
Yeah. So how much do we need? The average person, how much does the average person need of sleep every night?
Well, we know that the average sleep cycle is approximately 90 minutes long, and we know that the average person has 5 of those sleep cycles. So when you put that together, it's 450 minutes or approximately 7.5 hours worth of sleep. That's what we seem to think that most people require in terms of their overall need of sleep is around 7.5 hours, but everybody's different. I've been a 6.5 hour guy almost my whole life. I've got patients who need 9 hours. So the way to tell is when you wake up and feel refreshed and ready to meet the day, that's the amount of sleep that you need, that you require in order to feel good.
There's a distinction you make in the book between sleeping more and sleeping better.
Right. So there's a big difference between the quantity of sleep and the quality of sleep. And I think a lot of people kind of lose sight of that because we're always talking about minutes. You know, how many minutes of sleep did you get?
Yeah.
How long did you sleep for? Things like that. When in fact, we really need to look at the quality of the sleep that you're getting. And unfortunately, that's not an easy thing to do. We can look at things that can diminish the quality of your sleep. We see that happen with quite a few people. But, and things like caffeine or things like alcohol can diminish the quality of your sleep. But it's very hard to actually say, okay, I'm going to go to sleep right now and get higher quality sleep. I wish it worked that way, but it doesn't.
Yeah. Turns out also, and you've written about this, you can actually get too much sleep. There was this study you've written about, came out from the Centers for Disease Control, which talked about the fact that you can get too much. People do get too much sleep.
It is possible to get too much sleep. There was a great study that showed that people who sleep more than 10 hours actually have a double mortality rate, believe it or not. And so what we're thinking is going on there is that when people get too much sleep, there may be something else going on, like it's low quality, like you have sleep apnea, and therefore it's causing you to get more sleep. Or maybe you have depression. And depression is, you know, this one of the signs and symptoms of depression is excessive sleepiness. Sometimes it can have to do with a thyroid problem. People could be hypothyroid, and that can cause an increase in overall sleepiness. So there's a lot of different things that can actually cause you to sleep too long, which can be an indicator of something else.
One thing, it seems to me that this seems to be saying something about our body's rhythm, that our body is always looking for this kind of equilibrium, right? I mean, this idea of having a rhythm seems really important to a person's body.
It is. There's a circadian rhythm or an internal biological clock, and that's really the biggest factor in trying to understand how sleep works. And it's hard for people to kind of conceptually get it sometimes, but I think of it kind of like this. Sleep is a tube, is basically made up of two processes. And I think of it like the way I think of hunger. So if you're hungry, you know, it's like a drive. You're hungry, you're hungry, you're hungry. You eat something, and then that drive subsides. If you're sleepy, that sleepiness goes up and up and up, and then when you sleep a little bit, it subsides, okay? When you think about it from that perspective, the same holds true with hunger when the times you get ready to eat. When are you hungry? You're hungry at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So you're sleepy at a very particular time. We have inside us a biological clock. And this biological clock really plays a significant role in overall timing of many different things. Everything from melatonin production to when do we get hungry to temperature rhythms, things like that. So the big thing to remember here is that, yes, we all have a biological clock, and this biological clock has a lot to do with our overall behavior and health.
How important is it for it to be dark to sleep?
It turns out that darkness is one of the most crucial aspects, and here's why. Melatonin, which, remember, is kind of the key that starts the engine for sleep, is we call it the vampire hormone. It only comes out in the presence of darkness. So the darker your room is, the better. And most people don't realize that, and so let's say they go to bed very late, they think, oh, I'll just sleep in the morning, and they leave their shades open. Well, guess what happens? They left their shades open, the sunlight comes in, and lo and behold, they're going to have a difficult time maintaining good quality sleep. And you can still sense light even if your eyes are closed. That's why oftentimes I recommend for people to use a sleep mask or dark curtains or things like that.
Dr. Michael Bruce is with us, also known as the Sleep Doctor. He's a clinical psychologist, certified sleep specialist. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you have questions about your sleep? A lot of us do. 801-585-WEST. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about sleep. It's one of those necessary physiological functions, of course, but it's something a lot of us skip or neglect. We're continuing our series on fitness today by talking about sleep. The latest research is finding a deep connection. Not getting enough shut-eye can make your body store more fat, for example. But of course, there's more to it than that. We're talking about how sleep impacts our minds and our muscles. It even impacts our genes. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I wanted to ask you about stress, because this is something the role that stress plays in sleep. You've written about this, the impact it has, for example, on our immune system. You've written that the body's defense system against infection and disease is really weakened, really undermined by the physical effects of stress, and this plays into the importance of getting sleep. Talk about sleep in that way.
Oh, sure. So here's a couple. It seems to affect it in two ways. So number one, the less sleep you get, the more stressed you are.
Right.
There's lots of data to show that. We also know that the less sleep that you get, what you'll see is immune function decreases pretty dramatically. There was a great study at the University of Chicago where they took sleep-deprived people and then they took non-sleep-deprived people and they gave them the flu shot. And what they found was is that the flu shot was more effective the more sleep you got. So when you start to really dig down into it, what we see is killer T-cell increases. We see white blood cell increases. We see a lot of different physiologic functions that will change with better sleep. But also, I don't want to forget the mental component to not feeling so good. You know, a lot of people kind of don't necessarily think about it that way, but the truth of the matter is that if you're not feeling good mentally because of sleep deprivation, you're also likely to engage in health behaviors that are not going to be really all that great for you. And so I think that's also something that people need to really take into consideration and say, wow, getting better sleep helps me in every way. We know that sleep affects every organ system and every disease state. There is nothing that you can tell me that sleep deprivation will help you do.
You know, it's interesting. There's the mental component, and of course, there's the physical component. In the book that you've written that relates sleep to diet, you talk about what happens when you miss just one night, when you miss a night of sleep, just one night. You talk about how your skin gets pasty, your eyes get puffy, your prefrontal cortex shuts down, your insulin production increases, which means our bodies store more fat, we become irritable, we become achy. And you even say our ability to speak and remember is diminished. And we're just talking about one night.
It's pretty amazing how little it takes to have that happen. But yeah, you're absolutely correct. That's exactly what occurs. And the studies have actually been very clear, very good, in terms of what we're learning about people getting poor sleep. It affects everything. The biggest one that the book was most recently about had to look at metabolism, right? And so how could sleep, even just one night of poor sleep, affect metabolism? And here's what we found, is that people can actually become insulin resistant with just one night of no sleep. You know, the mitochondria, which are those energy packs in the cell, are what takes in sugar. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is the sugar isn't let through the door. It's kind of like the doorman is no longer letting the people in. And what we see is high blood sugar. And when you get high blood sugar, you get a pre-diabetic state, and that's a problem.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go to Sarah, I think it is, in Salt Lake. Sarah, welcome.
Sahar, hi.
Sahar, forgive me. Good morning.
I'd like to ask about jet lag. For instance, in the case of someone who's traveling from here to Europe, missing exactly 8 hours of sleep, which is one whole cycle, if you could talk about the issue and how best one can get over the jet lag.
This question, Dr. Bruce, has to come up time after time. People wondering, how do I get back in the rhythm after I've been, you know, traveling the world?
You know, it's very difficult to be able to actually do this without really understanding kind of the direction that people travel. But here's what I can tell you, is east is least and west is best. And so what I mean by that is traveling in an eastward direction is oftentimes very, very difficult, because what we're asking our body to do is to go to bed earlier, which can be a problem. You know, if I told you to go to bed at 8 o'clock tonight, it probably wouldn't be the easiest thing in the world to do.
Yeah.
But if I told you by traveling west that you had to stay up just a little bit later, then you probably wouldn't have much of a problem with it at all. One of the first things that I talk about with people is looking at the direction of travel. Once you understand the direction of travel, then it gets a little bit easier in terms of trying to understand your normal sleep pattern and how far off from that are you going to be. The body takes approximately 1 day per time zone to be able to adjust. And so, unfortunately, if you're going 8 to 10 time zones, then it can be a real issue for you. The good news here, though, is that if you plan yourself accordingly, you can make it so that it's not as big a deal. There's some great jet lag calculators that are apps that you can get on your telephone that I've used in the past with patients that can be extremely effective.
You know, we're going to take another break here really quickly, because I think we've got Dr. Bruce getting closer to this studio where he's supposed to be. I'm worried he's going to get killed. So we're going to take a break. But encourage you to give us a call. We'll get back to Dr. Michael Bruce in just a moment. Here's our number, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. And send your questions or your comments via email, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a few minutes break here and get Dr. Bruce safely into a studio and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. Michael Bruce, the sleep doctor, certified sleep specialist, author of the book, The Sleep Doctor's Diet Plan. We're talking about sleep as we continue our series on fitness, and I've had some technical issues to deal with, but Dr. Bruce has sort of gone the extra mile or extra two, I think, and made it into a studio. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Alex is with us in Orem, Utah. Alex, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I have a question here. I have a question for Dr. Bruce. So the last 5 months I've been living with my in-laws because I just had bad luck, lost a job. And so, but I just recently thought of that. I just recalled that. I don't recall being able to sleep properly, or in other words, having dreams. I don't recall having dreams for the last 5 months. And 4 days ago, I moved into my new place in Orem. And then suddenly, it's like I was back to normal. I could have vivid dreams. I wonder if there's any negative effect of not having those those dreams for the past 5 months. I know I've been under stress, even when I thought I was not stressed and I was okay, I was getting used to living with my in-laws. I still could not recall having any dreams.
Yeah, what a great... Dr. Bruce, what do you think? This idea of, are dreams an indicator that we're sleeping well or not sleeping well? Or what's the connection?
Well, it's kind of interesting. First of all, this is not an uncommon scenario. I'll have people tell me that they dream when they're home and they don't dream when they're on the road. I've had people tell me that during traumatic or stressful situations that can cause a lack of their remembering their dreams. Here's the good news. Your dream every night, whether you remember it or not, there are certain things that will help you remember that dream. Number one is if you wake up just as the dream is ending, you have a greater likelihood of remembering that dream than if you wake up in a lighter stage of sleep, like let's say stage one or stage two sleep. Now, what are the things that could have you in a lighter stage of sleep? Increased caffeine, different environment, things of that nature. So the good news is while we can't blame your bad sleep on your in-laws, we can say that you're probably going to sleep a lot better now that you're in a less stressful situation where you're on your own.
Yeah. Alex, thanks very much for the call. Boy, doctor, you sound much better there in a studio than on your cell phone. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Bob is with us in Bountiful, Utah. Bob, hi.
Hi. Question. You'd mentioned earlier, the doctor had mentioned about a kind of your internal clock and how you're set for your pattern. My tendency just always has naturally been to want to be awake at night, just kind of be a night owl, and I'm sleepy during daytime hours. And of course that doesn't mix with, you know, life and family and work and that sort of a thing.
Right.
If I had my druthers, that's just how I'd like to be. Can I change that through behavior and patterns? Is that kind of just the way I'm set?
Huh.
Well, there's two things that you need to know about this. Number one is people are kind of genetically set to either be a night owl or a morning lark or just kind of a regular socially normal sleeper. But there are some things that you can do to change it. But the changes are going to be temporary. For example, I've got patients who work the night shift 3 days a week, and then they want to work on regular shift the other 2 days a week. And so we use what's called light therapy, where we use specially designed light boxes. These are commercially available. You can buy them in stores, and you can use those in order to help reset that circadian clock. Remember how in the beginning of the show we were talking about how important is light? For somebody like you, light turns out to be a critical factor because it is something that we can use to change your circadian rhythms or your sleep habits. But I will also tell you at the end of the day, it's kind of hard to fool Mother Nature, and you're genetically predisposed to be in a particular way, and that's going to be something that you're going to be kind of fighting quite a bit.
Bob, thanks. It raises the question, and which you've written about, Dr. Bruce, can you ever catch up on your sleep? You know, can you just use the weekend to catch up?
Yes and no. You can catch up for about 30 minutes on the weekends, but if you go much longer than that, you will actually shift that circadian rhythm. And again, it's all about consistency.
Yeah.
And again, you just can't fool Mother Nature. If your body needs 7 hours of sleep a night, just get it. It'll make your life a whole heck of a lot easier. You will function better during your waking hours. You know, when people kind of try to cheat their sleep, it really doesn't work out particularly well. So as an example, if you know your body needs 7 hours and you consistently get 6 hours for 5 days in a row, by the time Friday and Saturday and Sunday hit, you're going to be exhausted and you're going to want to sleep in for maybe an extra 2 to 3 hours. Well, here's what's going to happen is your body is going to get so used to sleeping in that it's going to think that that's its new bedtime. And then your body's going to have to readjust and you're going to end up with something called the morning blues, which is waking up in the morning and hitting the snooze button about 12 times because your body really physically isn't ready to get up. It only takes 2 nights of sleeping off your pattern for your internal biological clock to change.
Wow. Thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Jody is with us in Salt Lake City. Hi, Jody.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Question regarding as you get older, say over 40 as a female, why is it that I seem to and other women I've talked to wake up the same time every night or early morning, say between the hours of 3 a.m. and 4 a.m.? I've heard some people say it could be your digestive system is starting to kick in, something to do with menopause. If you could explain the phenomenon, that would be great.
Sure. So this is actually very, very common. I've seen it happen in many, many patients, not just women, but I will say more women than men. And there's a couple of different things that could be going on. So one thing to look for is, could there be an environmental factor? So is the air conditioning unit kicking on? Is there a dog barking? Is the garbage truck going by? Is there some outside noise or distraction that could be happening at that time regularly? That's number one. Number two, when you get up at that time, do you actually have to go to the bathroom? A lot of people get up and they say, well, I'm up. I might as well see if I can go. That's really a bad idea. I'd much rather people actually stay in bed if they don't actually have to go to the bathroom. Number three is, are you feeling any pain? A lot of people will wake up in the middle of the night because they've had to shift positions and some type of pain has awoken them from the evening. And then some people just wake up for absolutely no reason and they look at the clock and it's 3:37 and they sit there and they do the mental math almost instantly. And they say, oh, I've got to be up at 6. Yeah. You know, I've only got 2.5 hours left. Oh, this is going to stink. Okay, I'm going to try to go to sleep. And you know what? It never really works very well. So the very first thing I tell people to do is turn the alarm clock around. The only information that you need in the middle of the night is your dreams. So just turn it around. Don't look at the clock. Try to allow yourself to not get too aggravated. Yes, you woke up. It's perfectly natural, by the way, to wake up 2 or 3 times a night and then fall back asleep relatively quickly. In fact, you probably do it and you don't even know it because your awakenings are so short. But if you do wake up and you realize, oh gosh, I'm up again, just roll over into a comfortable sleep position and I'm going to teach you a trick that I want you to do. I want you to count backwards from 300 by threes. Go ahead and try that for just a second, right? So 300, 297, 294, 291, 288. It's mathematically so complicated, you can't think of anything else, and it's so doggone boring, you're out like a light.
Right. Way better than sheep, right?
Way better.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Here's an email from Lucy. Lucy's worried because she's a shift worker, you know, both day and night shifts. And she was wondering about the long-term health effects of erratic sleep patterns. She writes, is it better for the body to have a more regular sleep schedule? I guess probably so, right?
It is. There have been numerous studies to show the incidence of cancer, the incidence of flu-like symptoms, of depression. The list really goes on and on for people who are shift workers. It really isn't very good for your health to be a shift worker. Now, don't get me wrong. There are some people who, remember we were talking before, who kind of naturally have that rhythm of they like to stay up at night and be asleep during the day. And those people kind of find their way into those jobs, at least sometimes. But if you're forcing your body into a shift work situation, it's not good. I mean, again, I hate to keep, you know, pounding the drum here, but you can't fool Mother Nature. Getting your body to be awake when it's supposed to be asleep is not going to be overall good for your health.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Back to the phones. Eric is joining us in West Valley. Eric, hi.
Hi. Quick question for you guys. I got laid off about a year ago, and I've had some health problems over the last 2 years. And basically, because of not working and the health problems caused, you know, basically I had a lot of severe pain.
Right.
Which is managed now.
Okay.
I found myself staying up later and later and later. I am married and we now have a 6-month-old. And I'm trying to back myself up so that I can get back to sleep at a normal hour and basically get ready to go back to work. And
sure.
I've taken myself from 4 a.m. back to 2 a.m. back to midnight. But from I need to get back to going to sleep at 10 p.m. And I cannot make the transition from midnight to 10 p.m.
Okay.
I've tried everything. Ambien,
no problem.
The whole works, and I just don't know what
to
do.
Nope. You're first of all, it's kind of a miracle that you're able to back yourself back from 4 to 2 to 12. So you should be congratulated for being able to do that. It all has to do with your wake-up time and the consistency of that wake-up time. When you have a job, what do you think your wake-up time will be? About 6, 6:30?
I don't have them with me anymore. I'm sorry. Let's just guess.
So all right, so let's guess and say that it'd be about 6:30. would be his wake-up time. Then, by the way, going to bed at midnight may not be such a bad idea. So what a lot of times I'll have people do is keep their wake-up time incredibly consistent even on the weekends. Huh. So what that does is it builds sleep drive throughout the day, making sure that they take no naps. And eventually, that drive will accumulate to be so high that it will help them start to fall asleep earlier and earlier. But they shouldn't try to fall asleep an hour earlier than the night before. They should only move about 15 minutes each week. Trying to make that big jump of, let's say, going from 12 to 11, it's just going to be frustrating. People get in bed, they can't fall asleep, they look at the ceiling, they get angry, and that just manifests the situation and makes it worse and worse. So have them getting up exactly at the same time, even on the weekends, no naps throughout the day, and consistently going to bed at the same time. As soon as they find themselves falling asleep, let's say for him at midnight and waking up at 6:30, if he's not feeling refreshed after that, then move it back to 11:45 for a week, then to 11:30 for a week, then to 11:15 for a week, and he'll keep going back down until he gets to where he feels refreshed. The way to know when you've hit the right bedtime for you is if you wake up within 5 minutes of your alarm, that's the amount of sleep you need.
Huh. You know, he made a reference, Eric, forgive me for cutting you off, but he made a reference to Ambien. Should we avoid that? Should people avoid that if they possibly can?
Well, here's the deal is I'm always a fan of the less medicine, the better.
Right.
I always have been. And sleep is a natural process. We can all sleep. As I said before, your sleeper isn't broken. You actually have the ability to sleep. Now, are there some cases where you may need some type of a pharmaceutical to help you out? You bet. I've got patients who, for example, have been diagnosed with cancer and are going through chemotherapy. They pretty much get whatever they need in order to help them sleep. People who have significant pain, you know, the gentleman who just called in said he had some pretty significant issues with pain.
Right.
That could be a scenario where it's used. The problem, though, is if you have a sleep problem and you take a pill to help you sleep, you end up with more than one problem. You end up with a sleep problem and a pill problem, usually. Sleep medications are really built for being used on an occasional basis or for a short period of time, 2 to 3 weeks. But the problem is with many of the sleep medications is they really work and they really work well.
Yeah.
And so people say, wow, I took this pill and I wake up and I feel better than I've felt in months. Why wouldn't I want to take that pill again? Even though there may not be a physiologic addiction, I believe that there's a very large psychological component that goes with many of these medications and we all have to be extremely careful with them.
Here's an email from Michael who writes from Salt Lake City. He says, my daughter and I both struggle with bipolar disorder. I'm painfully aware of the effects of poor sleep, but I'm also perpetually caught in a cyclical loop of mood imbalances, feeding sleep problems, some sleep problems, feeding depression and mania. He says, I see a lot of research linking sleep and mental and emotional wellness. What are your thoughts about this and breaking that cycle?
Okay, so this is a really tough situation. I've seen this happen. I've had patients like this before. The biggest thing that they have to do is they have to get their bipolar under some semblance of regularity and control before trying to attack their sleep problems. I know that sleep problems make bipolar worse. It makes depression worse and it makes mania worse. But if they can get stabilized on medication to help with their bipolar, then keeping that regular sleep schedule turns out to be one of the most important factors. Going to bed at the same time, waking up at the same time, avoiding things like caffeine and alcohol for these people is critical because those are two things that can affect that quality of sleep. Remember, it's not just about the minutes, it's about the quality of the sleep that you're getting, and that can have a pretty major effect as well. Some folks with bipolar, when they go into a manic phase, there's nothing we can do but to give them some type of a sleeping medication to get them back down into reality, if you will. But this is a very tough situation and something that they absolutely should work with a sleep specialist to try to help them out. I've got several of these types of patients in my practice. And while it takes a while, we do get them there.
There's a question coming in from James in Provo. James, let me see if I can ask it because it's the same question I had. It's about naps. I'm going to mention some of the few names that you've written about who were nappers. And these are people who are, you know, pretty successful in their lives. Albert Einstein was a napper and Thomas Edison was and Winston Churchill and Leonardo da Vinci. And you mentioned how Brahms was a napper. He was said to have been napping at his piano when he composed his lullaby. Talk about the advantage of naps or naps. I mean, we talked earlier about whether you can catch up if you've lost some. Where do naps fit in the scheme of things?
I love naps, except for people with insomnia. Huh. If you have a hard time falling asleep or staying asleep, napping is about the worst thing that you can do. Because remember, we talked about that sleep drive. And if your sleep drive is compromised by taking a nap, it's going to affect your ability to fall asleep at night. But let's say that you just don't have enough time in the day to sleep the allotted amount that works well for you. So let's say you only got 6 hours, but your body really needs 7.5.
Right.
Should you take a nap during the day? You bet you should. Even major corporations now are starting to look at this. Google has nap rooms. Huffington Post has nap rooms. America Online Corporate has nap rooms. These are places where what we know and understand is that sometimes life gets in the way of sleep. I get it. If it doesn't happen on a regular basis where we really need to look at a behavioral change and you need to take a 25-minute power nap, I say go for it. But there's really two types of naps. There's the 25-minute power nap, then there's the 90-minute full sleep cycle nap. If you go and take an hour-long nap, 9 out of 10 people will wake up feeling worse than when they started.
Yeah. You say
that's primarily – well, that's primarily because they actually get into deep sleep, and it's very hard to pull somebody out of deep sleep.
You say set aside 30 minutes because it takes you about 10 to sort of settle in.
Exactly.
And then 20 minutes is pretty much an ideal nap time.
Yeah, I love it. It works well because it reduces the amount of stage one and stage two. You get into stage one and stage two sleep, which reduces your sleep drive just enough to give you enough energy to make it through the day. But I'm going to teach everybody out there a secret. Okay. I call it the Napa latte.
Right.
Here's what I have people do. Okay. Is you go and you get a cup of drip coffee and cool it down. All right. Then you drink the whole thing really quickly and you take one of these 20-25 minute naps. You will have gotten enough stage one and stage two sleep to reduce your sleep drive. Your caffeine should be kicking in right around the 25 to 30 minute mark. You're good for 4 hours.
Wow. You said, but no later than 3:30 if you're taking a nap.
Exactly. That's correct.
Yeah. And this is the other thing that's important about that. You say, first of all, get comfortable when you're taking a nap.
Mm-hmm.
But
sure.
But don't be uncomfortable taking one. And this is,
right.
You know, people feel bad about taking naps. I don't know what it, like my father is this way. Like it's somehow bad if you take a nap, you're lazy or something like that. But you say, get comfortable with the idea of taking a nap.
Absolutely. There's really nothing wrong with taking a nap. I know historically society has said things like, oh, you're lazy, you know, you should be able. And it really seems to happen more with men than it does with women. You know, we're like these macho guys and we're thinking, oh, we can get by on 5.5, 6 hours of sleep. Yeah, no, not really. There's nothing wrong with napping. But what you need to do also is explain it to your employer. Hey, you know what? The baby was up last night. I only got 5 hours of sleep. I'm just going to go into the conference room and take a 25-minute nap. I know it'll help me. I'll feel more refreshed and I'll be more productive. What employer is really going to argue with something like that? Now, if you're doing it every single day and you're doing it for hours at a time, yeah, your employer might get a little upset. But if it's really something that you find is going to be helpful for you in terms of your productivity, it's definitely a key factor. I've got patients who actually bring a napping kit to work. Mm. So they have a small pillow, a small blanket, and a little travel alarm, or they use the alarm on their phone, and some eye shades, and they nap. The biggest factor when you're napping at work is safety, making sure that somebody knows where you are. You know, a lot of people will say that they'll go out to their car during lunch. That can be kind of dangerous, especially for females being out there by themselves. So let somebody know where you're going and what you're doing.
Let me combine a couple of email questions here related to being a new mom. Stephanie writes, mm-hmm. New moms rarely get an undisturbed full night of sleep. She says, I myself have not slept through the night for over a year. I generally get 7 hours of uninterrupted sleep. Is this sufficient? Am I not getting enough sleep? And Gabriella writes, I was wondering, she writes about sleep and being a new parent. Do we have something within us to be able to handle sleep deprivation while we're raising an infant? That's a great question.
It's a great question. And so the answer is kind of, sort of. The more sleep deprived we become, the less our brain identifies that we're sleep deprived.
Yeah.
So we kind of trick ourselves into thinking that we're not sleep deprived. But the truth of the matter is that we do not, especially for new moms. The sleep deprivation is terrible. I remember one patient turning to me and saying that after they had their first child, it was about 18 months later, and they were having their second child. And the thing that hurt worse was not the delivery of the child. It was the sleep deprivation.
Wow.
It really wreaks havoc on every aspect of your life, on your emotionality, on your physicality, on your mental abilities. I mean, I can't count the number of moms who say, I left the diaper bag on the top of the car because I was just so tired and I drove off, you know. Absolutely. And the dads as well. Absolutely, positively figure out a way to get enough sleep. If that means that one person takes one shift and one person takes the other shift, then go for it. If that means that you nap when your child naps instead of doing laundry, who cares if the laundry needs to be done or not? I'd much rather you get some sleep. So really finding strategic times to either nap or sleep with your child or get that rest at night is really going to be critical, especially for the decisions that you're going to be making now that you've got somebody who's so dependent upon you.
You've written some about sleep and kids. Let me read a few questions that come up. Marcy writes about her daughter being 8 years old, consistently been a bad sleeper, she says. She's trouble falling asleep. Mm-hmm. She wakes up early, comes into my room at least 3 times a week, she says. Our son, on the other hand, has never had a problem sleeping. We've always maintained the same routines, she says. The sleep situation of both of them is about the same. Here's the question, right, though. Are some kids just prone to not sleep well?
Yeah. Genetically speaking, we now know that there are some kids that are actually born genetically not great sleepers. These are kids who have what we call a temperament differences. So these are kids who react more to stimuli. These are kids who have a tendency to be colicky. These are children who have a tendency to cry more. And so, yeah, you can do the exact same thing with a brother and sister, and one can sleep well and one may not. And that's okay. Then you may need to change the sleep behaviors that occur that evening for those children. I know everybody says, I want to treat my children equal in every way, shape, and form. But in some ways, shapes, and forms, it's really not appropriate. So for those people who have children who are problem sleepers and other children who are good sleepers, you may want to have some different bedtime routines.
Mm. Speaking about bedtime routines, Sheila writes, my 9-year-old has a hard time going to bed because she's afraid of the dark. She wants to sleep with the light on. Any tips for getting her to bed without the light?
I don't necessarily mind her sleeping with the light on as long as it's not an overhead light that's going to prevent her from actually falling asleep. Many, many, many children sleep with a night light or a closet light on. And if it reduces their fear factor, then I say go for it. At the end of the day, you want to do what's most comforting for your child to allow them to fall asleep. The real question you want to ask is, what are they afraid of in the dark?
Yeah.
And how did that fear come about? If the answer is leave the closet light on, I get it. But you probably want to dig a little bit deeper and try to understand a little bit more about why that fear has come about and at why at this particular time has it come about. Usually nighttime fears are a result of some type of daytime stressor. And a lot of times it's not a stressor for the child, but it's a stressor within the family.
Catherine wants to know, do women need more sleep than men and why?
This is a great question. There have actually been a couple of studies to try to ferret this out, and each year it seems to flip-flop back and forth. The most recent data would suggest that women do need a little bit more sleep than men, and the thought process behind that is because women are much better at thinking about multiple things than men. It seems as though women are just much better at a lot of things than us, but specifically multitasking. And so women can actually do multiple tasks at the same time. And we think that that might just require a lot more energy overall, just in terms of your overall brain power. And we know that women, if they sleep an extra 20 to 25 minutes, can actually accomplish those tasks a lot better than men.
Let's go back to the phones. Kathy is with us in Highland, Utah. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I'd like to know if there's any research to show particular mattresses or pillows that are better for better sleep than others.
You're right about this.
Okay, so this is a great question. So I believe that mattresses and pillows are pieces of performance equipment. So I'm a runner. And if you go for a run in flip-flops and cutoffs with a torn T-shirt and a boombox on your arm, you're still going to get from the start of the race to the end of the race, but your time isn't going to be too good. But if you have on the right running shoes and your dry fit wear and your iPod, your time is going to be good. You got to remember that sleep is a performance activity. And if you've got the right equipment, you will perform better. That being said, everybody's body is a little bit different. So it's very hard to make a generalized recommendation for people. But I will tell you a couple of tips that I tell all of my patients that I think make sense. Before you go out and buy a mattress, find the right pillow. So many people are using pillows that are too old, too squished, not giving enough support. And that's the very first thing. Unfortunately, when you go to the store, there's this great big pillow wall and you walk over to it and you pick out a package that looks kind of good. And then you kind of push your head against the side of it thinking, well, maybe this one will do the trick. And you throw it in the cart and you go home. What you really want to think about is if you're a side sleeper, you want a little bit thicker pillow because you have to make up for the space between your ear and the end of the bed. However, there's a caveat is because some side sleepers are what I call Superman sleepers, where their arm kind of juts out underneath the pillow. So they actually need a thinner pillow to make up for that small space between their arm and their ear. If you're a back sleeper, which 25% of us are, then you're going to want a very, very thin pillow. You don't want something that's going to pitch your head forward because it can compromise your breathing. If you're a stomach sleeper, it's the worst position you can possibly sleep in. And in some cases, you don't even want a pillow because all that's going to do is torque your neck into a different direction. But let's say you've discovered a great pillow for you. By the way, you should be changing your pillow about once every 18 months. And you shouldn't just have one pillow. People don't think about this, but in fact, if you've been working all week at a computer and your neck is kind of strained, you may need a certain amount of neck support, whereas on the weekend where you're not doing that, you may no longer need that kind of neck support. So also think about having a couple of different pillows in the closet that you can kind of pick and choose from as you need them. But once you've got your pillow, bring it to the store. You want to go to the store with the pillow, especially the mattress store, I guess, not the grocery store, and what you really want to do is lie down on the bed. Most people don't know this, but when you lie down, your heart rate slows down. And when your heart rate slows down, oxygen isn't distributed in the same fashion that it was previously. And muscles are going to hold on to their oxygen while it's waiting for new oxygen to show up. That's called tension, and people can't feel the bed. So what I tell people to do is lie down on a bed in your starting sleep position with your pillow and lie there for at least 6 to 7 minutes. Then your body has had a chance to recalibrate and you can actually feel the bed. I can't count the number of people who walk into the mattress store and they plant their butt down or put their knee on the bed and they say, yeah, this one feels comfortable. Really bad idea. Once you get down there for 6 or 7 minutes with your pillow, then rotate to another position for another 6 or 7 minutes, and then another position for 6 or 7 minutes. Only then will you truly be able to understand if this is going to give you the support that you need. Because think about it, you know, during the daytime when you're walking around, you're trying to keep good posture, right? So posture being maybe your shoulders are back a little bit, your chest is out, your spine is straight. Well, who do you think's watching your posture while you sleep? It's your mattress. So you really want to make sure that your mattress is allowing you to have the sleep posture that you need.
It's Dr. Michael Bruce. He's the sleep doctor, certified sleep specialist, author of the book, The Sleep Doctor's Diet Plan, Lose Weight Through Better Sleep. Doctor, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, thank you. This was lots of fun. I always enjoy these.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. Go to our website to continue the conversation or ask more questions. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We'll be right back.